doctor to that of a single AI doctor. Rather, we should compare the abilities of a collection of human individuals to the abilities of an integrated network. For example, many drivers are unfamiliar with all the changing traffic regulations, and they often violate them. In addition, since every vehicle is an autonomous entity, when two vehicles approach the same intersection at the same time, the drivers might miscommunicate their intentions and collide. Self-driving cars, in contrast, can all be connected to one another. When two such vehicles approach the same junction, they are not really two separate entities. They are part of a single algorithm. The chances that they might miscommunicate and collide are therefore far smaller. And if the transportation department decides to change some traffic regulation, all self-driving vehicles can be easily updated at exactly the same moment, and, barring some bug in the program, they will all follow the new regulation to the letter. Similarly, if the World Health Organization identifies a new disease, or if a laboratory produces a new medicine, it is almost impossible to update all the human doctors in the world about these developments. In contrast, even if you have 10 billion AI doctors in the world, each monitoring the health of a single human being, you can still update all of them within a split second, and they can all communicate to each other their feedback on the new disease or medicine. These potential advantages of connectivity and updatability are so huge that at least in some lines of work it might make sense to replace all humans with computers, even if individually some humans still do a better job than the machines. You might object that by switching from individual humans to a computer network, we will lose the advantages of individuality. For example, if one human doctor makes a wrong judgment, he does not kill all the patients in the world, and he does not block the development of all new medications. In contrast, if all doctors are really just a single system, and that system makes a mistake, the results might be catastrophic. In truth, however, an integrated computer system can maximize the advantages of connectivity without losing the benefits of individuality. You can run many alternative algorithms on the same network, so a patient in a remote jungle village can access through her smartphone not just a single authoritative doctor, but actually 100 different AI doctors whose relative performance is constantly being compared. You don't like what the IBM doctor told you? No problem. Even if you are stranded somewhere on the slopes of Kilimanjaro, you can easily contact the Baidu doctor for a second opinion. The benefits for human society are likely to be immense. AI doctors could provide far better and cheaper healthcare for billions of people, particularly for those who currently receive no healthcare at all. Thanks to learning algorithms and biometric sensors, a poor villager in an underdeveloped country might come to enjoy far better healthcare via her smartphone than the richest person in the world gets today from the most advanced urban hospital. Similarly, self-driving vehicles could provide people with much better transportation services, and in particular, reduce mortality from traffic accidents. Today, close to 1.25 million people are killed annually in traffic accidents, twice the number killed by war, crime, and terrorism combined. More than 90% of these accidents are caused by very human errors. Somebody drinking alcohol and driving, somebody texting a message while driving, somebody falling asleep at the wheel, somebody daydreaming instead of paying attention to the road. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimated in 2012 that 31% of fatal crashes in the United States involved alcohol abuse, 30% involved speeding, and 21% involved distracted drivers. Self-driving vehicles will never do any of these things. Though they suffer from their own problems and limitations, and though some accidents are inevitable, replacing all human drivers by computers is expected to reduce deaths and injuries on the road by about 90%. In other words, switching to autonomous vehicles is likely to save the lives of 1 million people every year. It would therefore be madness to block automation in fields such as transport and healthcare just in order to protect human jobs. After all, what we ultimately ought to protect is humans, not jobs. Displaced drivers and doctors We'll just have to find something else to do. The Mozart in the Machine. At least in the short term, AI and robotics are unlikely to completely eliminate entire industries. Jobs that require specialization in a narrow range of routinized activities will be automated. But it will be much more difficult to replace humans with machines in less routine jobs that demand the simultaneous use of a wide range of skills and involve dealing with unforeseen scenarios. Take healthcare, for example. Many doctors focus almost exclusively on processing information. They absorb medical data, analyze it, and produce a diagnosis. Nurses, in contrast, need good motor and emotional skills in order to give a painful injection, replace a bandage, or restrain a violent patient. Therefore, we will probably have an AI family doctor on our smartphone decades before we have a reliable nurse robot. The human care industry, which takes care of the sick, the young, and the elderly, is likely to remain a human bastion for a long time. Indeed, as people live longer and have fewer children, care of the elderly will probably be one of the fastest-growing sectors in the human labor market. Alongside care, creativity, too, poses particularly difficult hurdles for automation. We don't need humans to sell us music anymore. We can download it directly from the iTunes store. But the composers, musicians, singers, and DJs are still flesh and blood. We rely on their creativity, not just to produce completely new music, but also to choose among a mind-boggling range of available possibilities. Nevertheless, in the long run, no job will remain absolutely safe from automation. Even artists should be put on notice. In the modern world, art is usually associated with human emotions. We tend to think that artists are channeling internal psychological forces, and that the whole purpose of art is to connect us with our emotions, or to inspire in us some new feeling. Consequently, when we come to evaluate art, we tend to judge it by its emotional impact on the audience. Yet, if art is defined by human emotions, what might happen once external algorithms are able to understand and manipulate human emotions better than Shakespeare, Frida Kahlo, or Beyoncé? After all, emotions are not some mystical phenomenon. They are the result of a biochemical process. Therefore, in the not-too-distant future, a machine learning algorithm could analyze the biometric data streaming from sensors on and inside your body, determine your personality type and your changing moods, and calculate the emotional impact that a particular song, even a particular musical key, is likely to have on you. Of all forms of art, music is probably the most susceptible to big data analysis, because both inputs and outputs lend themselves to precise mathematical depiction. The inputs are the mathematical patterns of sound waves, and the outputs are the electrochemical patterns of neural storms. Within a few decades, an algorithm that goes over millions of musical experiences might learn to predict how particular inputs result in particular outputs. Suppose you just had a nasty fight with your boyfriend. The algorithm in charge of your sound system will immediately discern your inner emotional turmoil, and, based on what it knows about you personally and about human psychology in general, it will play songs tailored to resonate with your gloom and echo your distress. These particular songs might not work well with other people, but they are just perfect for your personality type. After helping you get in touch with the depths of your sadness, the algorithm would then play the one song in the world that is likely to cheer you up, perhaps because your subconscious connected with a happy childhood memory that even you are not aware of. No human DJ could ever hope to match the skills of such an AI. You might object that the AI would thereby kill serendipity and lock us inside a narrow musical cocoon woven by our previous likes and dislikes. What about exploring new musical tastes and styles? No problem. You could easily adjust the algorithm to make 5% of its choices completely at random, unexpectedly throwing at you a recording of an Indonesian gamelan ensemble, a Rossini opera, or the latest K-pop hit. Over time, by monitoring your reactions, the AI could even determine the ideal level of randomness that will optimize exploration while avoiding annoyance, perhaps lowering its serendipity level to 3%, or raising it to 8%. Another possible objection is that it is unclear how the algorithm could establish its emotional goal. If you just fought with your boyfriend, should the algorithm aim to make you sad or joyful? Would it blindly adhere to a rigid set of good and bad emotions? Maybe there are times in life when it's good to feel sad. The same question, of course, could be directed at human musicians and DJs. Yet, with an algorithm, there are many interesting solutions to this puzzle. One option is to just leave it to the customer. You can evaluate your emotions whichever way you like, and the algorithm will follow your dictates. Whether you want to wallow in self-pity or jump for joy, the algorithm will slavishly follow your lead. Indeed, the algorithm may learn to recognize your wishes even without your being explicitly aware of them. Alternatively, if you don't trust yourself, you might instruct the algorithm to follow the recommendation of whichever eminent psychologist you do trust. If your boyfriend eventually dumps you, the algorithm may walk you through the official 5 stages of grief, first helping you deny what happened by playing Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy, then whipping up your anger with Alanis Morissette's You Ought to Know, encouraging you to bargain with Jacques Brel's Ne Me Quitte Pas, and Paul Young's Come Back and Stay, dropping you into the pit of depression with Adele's Someone Like You and Hello, and finally helping you accept the situation with Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. The next step might be for the algorithm to start tinkering with the songs and melodies themselves, changing them ever so slightly to fit your quirks. Perhaps you dislike a particular bit in an otherwise excellent song. The algorithm knows it because your heart skips a beat and your oxytocin levels drop slightly whenever you hear that annoying part. The algorithm could rewrite or edit out the offending notes. In the long run, algorithms may learn how to compose entire tunes, playing on human emotions as if they were a piano keyboard. Using your biometric data, the algorithms could even produce personalized melodies, which you alone in the entire universe would appreciate. It is often said that people connect with art because they find themselves in it. This may lead to surprising and somewhat sinister results if and when, say, Facebook begins creating personalized art based on everything it knows about you. If your boyfriend leaves you, Facebook will treat you to an individualized song about that particular bastard, rather than about the unknown person who broke the heart of Adele or Alanis Morissette. The song will even remind you of real incidents from your relationship that nobody else in the world knows about. Of course, personalized art might never catch on, because people will continue to prefer common hits that everybody likes. How can you dance or sing together to a song nobody besides you knows? But algorithms could prove even more adept at producing global hits than personalized rarities. By using massive biometric databases garnered from millions of people, the algorithm could know which biochemical buttons to press in order to produce a global hit that would get everybody swinging like crazy on the dance floors. If art is really about inspiring or manipulating human emotions, few, if any, human musicians will be able to compete with such an algorithm because they cannot match it in understanding the chief instrument they are playing on, the human biochemical system. Will all this result in great art? That depends on the definition of art. If beauty is indeed in the ears of the listener, and if the customer is always right, then biometric algorithms stand a chance of producing the best art in history. If art is about something deeper than human emotions, and should express a truth beyond our biochemical vibrations, biometric algorithms might not make very good artists. But neither do most humans. In order to enter the art market and displace many human composers and performers, algorithms won't have to begin by surpassing Tchaikovsky. It would be enough if they outperform Britney Spears. New jobs? The loss of many traditional jobs in everything from art to healthcare will partly be offset by the creation of new human jobs. Primary care doctors who focus on diagnosing known diseases and administering familiar treatments will probably be replaced by AI doctors. But precisely because of that, there will be much more money to pay human doctors and lab assistants to do groundbreaking research and develop new medicines or surgical procedures. AI might help create new human jobs in another way. Instead of humans competing with AI, they could focus on servicing and leveraging AI. For example, the replacement of human pilots by drones has eliminated some jobs, but created many new opportunities in maintenance, remote control, data analysis, and cybersecurity. The U.S. Armed Forces need 30 people to operate every unmanned Predator or Reaper drone flying over Syria, while analyzing the resulting harvest of information occupies at least 80 people more. In 2015, the U.S. Air Force lacked sufficient trained humans to fill all these positions, and therefore faced an ironic crisis in manning its unmanned aircraft. If so, the job market of 2050 might well be characterized by human-AI cooperation rather than competition. In fields ranging from policing to banking, teams of humans plus AIs could outperform both humans and computers. After IBM's chess program, Deep Blue, beat Garry Kasparov in 1997, humans did not stop playing chess. Rather, thanks to AI trainers, human chess masters became better than ever, and at least for a while, human AI teams, known as centaurs, outperformed both humans and computers in chess. AI might similarly help groom the best detectives, bankers, and soldiers in history. The problem with all such new jobs, however, is that they will probably demand high levels of expertise, and will therefore not solve the problems of unemployed, unskilled laborers. Creating new human jobs might prove easier than retraining humans to actually fill these jobs. During previous waves of automation, people could usually switch from one routine low-skill job to another. In 1920, a farm worker laid off due to the mechanization of agriculture could find a new job in a factory producing tractors. In 1980, an unemployed factory worker could start working as a cashier in a supermarket. Such occupational changes were feasible because the move from farm to factory and from factory to supermarket required only limited retraining. But in 2050, a cashier or textile worker losing her job to a robot will not be able to start working as a cancer researcher, as a drone operator, or as part of a human AI banking team. She won't have the necessary skills. In the First World War, it made sense to send millions of raw conscripts to charge machine guns and die in the thousands. Their individual skills mattered little. Today, despite the shortage of drone operators and data analysts, the U.S. Air Force is unwilling to fill the gaps with Walmart dropouts. You wouldn't want an inexperienced recruit to mistake an Afghan wedding party for a high-level Taliban conference. Consequently, despite the appearance of many new human jobs, we might nevertheless witness the rise of a new useless class. We might actually get the worst of both worlds, suffering simultaneously from high unemployment and a shortage of skilled labor. Many people might share the fate not of 19th century wagon drivers who switched to driving taxis, but of 19th century horses who were increasingly pushed out of the job market altogether. In addition, no remaining human job will ever be safe from the threat of future automation, because machine learning and robotics will continue to improve. A 40-year-old unemployed Walmart cashier, who, through superhuman effort, manages to reinvent herself as a drone pilot, might have to reinvent herself again 10 years later, because by then the flying of drones may also have been automated. This volatility will also make it more difficult to organize unions or secure labor rights. Already today, many new jobs in advanced economies involve unprotected temporary work, freelancing, and one-time gigs. How do you unionize a profession that mushrooms and disappears within a decade? Similarly, human-computer centaur teams are likely to be characterized by a constant tug of war between the humans and the computers, instead of settling down to a lifelong partnership. Teams made exclusively of humans, such as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, usually develop permanent hierarchies and routines that last decades. But a human detective who teams up with IBM's Watson computer system, which became famous after winning the TV quiz show Jeopardy in 2011, will find that every routine is an invitation for disruption, every hierarchy an invitation for revolution. Yesterday's sidekick might morph into tomorrow's superintendent, and all protocols and manuals will have to be rewritten each year. A closer look at the world of chess might indicate where things are heading in the long run. It is true that for several years after Deep Blue defeated Kasparov, human-computer cooperation flourished in chess. Yet in recent years, computers have become so good at playing chess that their human collaborators have lost their value and might soon become utterly irrelevant. On December 7, 2017, a critical milestone was reached, not when a computer defeated a human at chess, that's old news, but when Google's AlphaZero program defeated the Stockfish 8 program. Stockfish 8 was the world's computer chess champion for 2016. It had access to centuries of accumulated human experience in chess, as well as decades of computer experience. It was able to calculate 70 million chess positions per second. In contrast, AlphaZero performed only 80,000 such calculations per second, and its human creators had not taught it any chess strategies, not even standard openings. Rather, AlphaZero used the latest machine learning principles to self-learn chess by playing against itself. Nevertheless, out of 100 games the novice AlphaZero played against Stockfish, AlphaZero won 28 and tied 72. It didn't lose even once. Since AlphaZero had learned nothing from any human, many of its winning moves and strategies seemed unconventional to the human eye. They may well be considered creative, if not downright genius. Can you guess how long it took AlphaZero to learn chess from scratch, prepare for the match against Stockfish, and develop its genius instincts? 4 hours. That's not a typo. For centuries, chess was considered one of the crowning glories of human intelligence. AlphaZero went from utter ignorance to creative mastery in 4 hours, without the help of any human guide. AlphaZero is not the only imaginative software out there. Many programs now routinely outperform human chess players, not just in brute calculation, but even in creativity. In human-only chess tournaments, judges are constantly on the lookout for players who try to cheat by secretly getting help from computers. One of the ways to catch cheaters is to monitor the level of originality players display. If they play an exceptionally creative move, the judges will often suspect that it cannot possibly be a human move. It must be a computer move. At least in chess, creativity is already considered to be the trademark of computers rather than humans. So if chess is our canary in the coal mine, we are duly warned that the canary is dying. What is happening today to human AI chess teams might happen down the road to human AI teams in policing, medicine, and banking too. Consequently, creating new jobs and retraining people to fill them will not be a one-time effort. The AI revolution won't be a single watershed event, after which the job market will just settle into a new equilibrium. Rather, it will be a cascade of ever bigger disruptions. Already today, few employees expect to work in the same job for their entire life. By 2050, not only the idea of a job for life, but even that of a profession for life might seem antediluvian. Even if we could constantly invent new jobs and retrain the workforce, we might wonder whether the average human would have the emotional stamina necessary for a life of such endless upheavals. Change is always stressful, and the hectic world of the early 21st century has produced a global epidemic of stress. As the volatility of the job market and of individual careers increases, will people be able to cope? We will probably need far more effective stress reduction techniques, ranging from drugs to neurofeedback to meditation, to prevent the human mind from snapping. By 2050, a useless class might emerge due not merely to an absolute lack of jobs or a lack of relevant education, but also to insufficient mental stamina. Obviously, most of this is just speculation. At the time of writing, early 2018, automation has disrupted many industries, but it has not resulted in massive unemployment. In fact, in many countries, such as the United States, unemployment is at a historical low. Nobody can know for sure what sort of impact machine learning and automation will have on different professions in the future, and it is extremely difficult to estimate the timetable of relevant developments, especially because they depend on political decisions and cultural traditions as much as on purely technological breakthroughs. Thus, even after self-driving vehicles prove themselves safer and cheaper than human drivers, politicians and consumers might nevertheless block the change for years, perhaps decades. However, we cannot allow ourselves to be complacent. It is dangerous to just assume that enough new jobs will appear to compensate for any losses. The fact that this has happened during previous waves of automation is absolutely no guarantee that it will happen again under the very different conditions of the 21st century. The potential social and political disruptions are so alarming that even if the probability of systemic mass unemployment is low, we should take it very seriously. In the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution created new conditions and problems that none of the existing social, economic, and political models could cope with. Feudalism, monarchism, and traditional religions were not adapted to managing industrial metropolises, millions of uprooted workers, or the constantly changing nature of the modern economy. Consequently, humankind had to develop completely new models, liberal democracies, communist dictatorships, and fascist regimes, and it took more than a century of terrible wars and revolutions to experiment with these models, separate the wheat from the chaff, and implement the best solutions. Child labor in Dickensian coal mines, the First World War, and the Great Ukrainian Famine of 1932-33 constituted just a small part of the tuition fees humankind had to pay. The challenge posed to humankind in the 21st century by infotech and biotech is arguably much bigger than the challenge posed in the previous era by steam engines, railroads, and electricity. And, given the immense destructive power of our civilization, we just cannot afford more failed models, world wars, and bloody revolutions. This time around, the failed models might result in nuclear wars, genetically engineered monstrosities, and a complete breakdown of the biosphere. We have to do better than we did in confronting the Industrial Revolution. From exploitation to irrelevance. Potential solutions fall into three main categories. What to do in order to prevent jobs from being lost, what to do in order to create enough new jobs, and what to do if, despite our best efforts, job losses significantly outstrip job creation. Preventing job losses altogether is an unattractive and probably untenable strategy, because it means giving up the immense positive potential of AI and robotics. Nevertheless, governments might decide to deliberately slow down the pace of automation in order to lessen the resulting shocks and allow time for readjustments. Technology is never deterministic, and the fact that something can be done does not mean it must be done. Government regulation can successfully block new technologies, even if they are commercially viable and economically lucrative. For example, for many decades we have had the technology to create a marketplace for human organs, complete with human body farms in underdeveloped countries, and an almost insatiable demand from desperate, affluent buyers. Such body farms could well be worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Yet regulations have prevented free trade in human body parts, and though there is a black market in organs, it is far smaller and more circumscribed than what one might have expected. Slowing down the pace of change may give us time to create enough new jobs to replace most of the losses. Yet, as noted earlier, economic entrepreneurship will have to be accompanied by a revolution in education and psychology. Assuming that the new jobs won't be just government sinecures, they will probably demand high levels of expertise, and as AI continues to improve, human employees will need to repeatedly learn new skills and change their profession. Governments will have to step in, both by subsidizing a lifelong education sector and by providing a safety net for the inevitable periods of transition. If a 40-year-old former drone pilot takes 3 years to reinvent herself as a designer of virtual worlds, she may well need a lot of government help to sustain herself and her family during that time. This kind of scheme is currently being pioneered in Scandinavia, where governments follow the motto, "Protect workers, not jobs." Yet even if enough government help were forthcoming, it is far from clear that billions of people would be able to repeatedly reinvent themselves without losing their mental balance. For this reason, if, despite all our efforts, a significant percentage of humankind is pushed out of the job market, we would have to explore new models for post-work societies, post-work economies, and post-work politics. The first step is to honestly acknowledge that the social, economic, and political models we have inherited from the past are inadequate for dealing with such a challenge. Take, for example, communism. As automation threatens to shake the capitalist system to its foundation, one might suppose that communism would make a comeback. But communism was not built to exploit that kind of crisis. 20th century communism assumed that the working class was vital for the economy, and communist thinkers tried to teach the proletariat how to translate its immense economic power into political clout. The communist political plan called for a working class revolution. How relevant will these teachings be if the masses lose their economic value and therefore need to struggle against irrelevance rather than against exploitation? How do you start a working-class revolution without a working class? Some might argue that humans could never become economically irrelevant, because even if they cannot compete with AI in the workplace, they will always be needed as consumers. However, it is far from certain that the future economy will need us even as consumers. Machines and computers could do that too. Theoretically, you can have an economy in which a mining corporation produces and sells iron to a robotics corporation, and the robotics corporation produces and sells robots to the mining corporation, which mines more iron, which is used to produce more robots, and so on. These corporations can grow and expand to the far reaches of the galaxy, and all they need are robots and computers. They don't even need humans to buy their products. In fact, today, computers and algorithms are already beginning to function as clients in addition to being producers. In the stock exchange, for example, algorithms are becoming the most important buyers of bonds, shares, and commodities. Similarly, in the advertising business, the most important customer of all is an algorithm, the Google search algorithm. When people design web pages, they often cater to the taste of the Google search algorithm rather than to the taste of any human being. Algorithms obviously have no consciousness, so unlike human consumers, they cannot enjoy what they buy, and their decisions are not shaped by sensations and emotions. The Google search algorithm cannot taste ice cream. However, algorithms select things based on their internal calculations and built-in preferences, and these preferences increasingly shape our world. The Google search algorithm has a very sophisticated taste when it comes to ranking the web pages of ice cream vendors, and the most successful ice cream vendors in the world are those that the Google algorithm ranks first, not those that produce the tastiest ice cream. I know this from personal experience. When I publish a book, my publishers ask me to write a short description that they use for publicity online. But they have a special expert who adapts what I write to the taste of the Google algorithm. The expert goes over my text and says, "Don't use this word, use that word instead. Then we will get more attention from the Google algorithm." We know that if we can just catch the eye of the algorithm, we can take the humans for granted. So, if humans are needed neither as producers nor as consumers, what will safeguard their physical survival and their psychological well-being? We cannot wait for the crisis to erupt in full force before we start looking for answers. By then, it will be too late. In order to cope with the unprecedented technological and economic disruptions of the 21st century, we need to develop new social and economic models as soon as possible. These models should be guided by the principle of protecting humans rather than jobs. Many jobs are uninspiring drudgery and are not worth saving. Nobody's life dream is to be a cashier. We should focus instead on providing for people's basic needs and protecting their social status and self-worth. One new model gaining increasing attention is universal basic income. UBI proposes that governments tax the billionaires and corporations controlling the algorithms and robots and use that money to provide every person with a generous stipend covering his or her basic needs. This will cushion the poor against job loss and economic dislocation, while protecting the rich from populist rage. A related idea proposes to widen the range of human activities that are considered to be jobs. At present, billions of parents take care of children, neighbors look after one another, and citizens organize communities, without any of these valuable activities being recognized as jobs. Maybe we need to flip a switch in our minds and realize that taking care of a child is arguably the most important and challenging job in the world. If so, there won't be a shortage of work, even if computers and robots replace all the drivers, bankers, and lawyers. The question, of course, is who would evaluate and pay for these newly recognized jobs. Assuming that six-month-old babies will not pay a salary to their mothers, the government will probably have to take this expense upon itself. Assuming, too, that we would want these salaries to cover all of a family's basic needs, the end result will be something that is not very different from universal basic income. Alternatively, governments could subsidize universal basic services rather than income. Instead of giving money to people who then shop around for whatever they want, the government might subsidize free education, free healthcare, free transportation, and so forth. This is, in fact, the utopian vision of communism. Though the communist plan to start a working-class revolution might well become outdated, perhaps we should still aim to realize the communist goal by other means. It is debatable whether it is better to provide people with universal basic income, the capitalist paradise, or universal basic services, the communist paradise. Both options have advantages and drawbacks. But no matter which paradise you choose, the real problem is in defining what universal and basic actually mean. What is universal? When people speak about universal basic support, whether in the shape of income or services, they usually mean national basic support. Until now, all UBI initiatives have been strictly national or municipal. In January 2017, Finland began a two-year experiment, providing 2,000 unemployed Finns with 560 euros a month, irrespective of whether they found work or not. Similar experiments are underway in the Canadian province of Ontario, in the Italian city of Livorno, and in several Dutch cities. In 2016, Switzerland held a referendum on instituting a national basic income scheme, but voters rejected the idea. The problem with such national and municipal schemes, however, is that the main victims of automation may not live in Finland, Ontario, Livorno, or Amsterdam. Globalization has made people in one country utterly dependent on markets in other countries, but automation might unravel large parts of this global trade network with disastrous consequences for the weakest links. In the 20th century, developing countries lacking natural resources made economic progress mainly by selling the cheap labor of their unskilled workers. Today, millions of Bangladeshis make a living by producing shirts and selling them to customers in the United States, while people in Bangalore earn their keep in call centers dealing with the complaints of American customers. Yet, with the rise of AI, robots, and 3D printers, cheap, unskilled labor will become far less important. Instead of manufacturing a shirt in Dhaka and shipping it all the way to the United States, you could buy the shirt's code online from Amazon and print it in New York. The Zara and Prada stores on Fifth Avenue, could be replaced by 3D printing centers in Brooklyn, and some people might even have a printer at home. Simultaneously, instead of calling customer service in Bangalore to complain about your printer, you could talk with an AI representative in the Google Cloud, whose accent and tone of voice would be tailored to your preferences. The newly unemployed workers and call center operators in Dhaka and Bangalore don't have the education necessary to switch to designing fashionable shirts or writing computer code. So how will they survive? If AI and 3D printers indeed take over from the Bangladeshis and Bangaloreans, the revenues that previously flowed to South Asia will now fill the coffers of a few tech giants in California. Instead of economic growth improving conditions all over the world, we might see immense new wealth created in high-tech hubs such as Silicon Valley, while many developing countries collapse. Of course, some emerging economies, including India and Bangladesh, might advance fast enough to join the winning team. The children or grandchildren of textile workers and call center operators might well become the engineers and entrepreneurs who build and own the computers and 3D printers. But the time to make such a transition is running out. In the past, cheap, unskilled labor served as a secure bridge across the global economic divide, and even if a country advanced slowly, it could expect to reach safety eventually. Taking the right steps was more important than making speedy progress. Yet now the bridge is shaking, and soon it might collapse. Those who have already crossed it, graduating from cheap labor to high-skill industries, will probably be okay. But those lagging behind might find themselves stuck on the wrong side of the chasm, without any means of crossing over. What do you do when nobody needs your cheap, unskilled laborers, and you don't have the resources to build a good education system and teach them new skills? What then will be the fate of the stragglers? American voters might conceivably agree that taxes paid by Amazon and Google for their U.S. business could be used to give stipends or free services to unemployed miners in Pennsylvania and jobless taxi drivers in New York. But would American voters also agree that these taxes should be sent to support unemployed people in places defined by President Trump as shithole countries? If you believe that, you might just as well believe that Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny will solve the problem. What is BASIC? Universal basic support is meant to take care of basic human needs, but there is no accepted definition for that. From a purely biological perspective, a human being needs just 1,500 to 2,500 calories per day in order to survive. Anything more is a luxury. Yet over and above this biological poverty line, every culture in history has defined additional needs as basic. In medieval Europe, access to church services was seen as even more important than food, because religion took care of your eternal soul rather than your ephemeral body. In today's Europe, decent education and healthcare services are considered basic human needs, and some argue that even access to the internet is now essential for every man, woman, and child. If in 2050 the United World Government agrees to tax Google, Amazon, Baidu, and Tencent in order to provide basic support for every human being on Earth, in Dhaka as well as in Detroit, how will it define basic? For example, what does basic education include? Just reading and writing? Or also composing computer code and playing the violin? Just 6 years of elementary school? Or everything up to a PhD? And what about healthcare? If by 2050 medical advances make it possible to slow down the aging process and significantly extend human lifespans, will the new treatments be available to all 10 billion humans on the planet, or just to a few billionaires? If biotechnology enables parents to upgrade their children, would this be considered a basic human need? Or would we see humankind splitting into different biological castes, with rich superhumans enjoying abilities that far surpass those of poor Homo sapiens? Whichever way you choose to define basic human needs, once you provide them to everyone free of charge, they will be taken for granted, and then fierce social competitions and political struggles will focus on luxuries, be they fancy self-driving cars, access to virtual reality parks, or enhanced bioengineered bodies. Yet if the unemployed masses command no economic assets, it is hard to see how they could ever hope to obtain such luxuries. Consequently, the gap between the rich, Tencent managers and Google shareholders, and the poor, those dependent on universal basic income, might become not merely bigger, but actually unbridgeable. For this reason, even if some universal support scheme provides poor people in 2050 with much better healthcare and education than they receive today, they might still be extremely angry about global inequality and the lack of social mobility. People will feel that the system is rigged against them, that the government serves only the super rich, and that the future will be even worse for them and their children. Homo sapiens is just not built for satisfaction. Human happiness depends less on objective conditions and more on our own expectations. Expectations, however, tend to adapt to conditions, including the conditions of other people. When things improve, expectations balloon, and so even dramatic improvements in conditions might leave us as dissatisfied as before. If universal basic support is aimed at improving the objective conditions of the average person in 2050, it has a fair chance of succeeding. But if it is aimed at making people subjectively more satisfied with their lot and preventing social discontent, it is likely to fail. To really achieve its goals, universal basic support will have to be supplemented with some meaningful pursuits, ranging from sports to religion. Perhaps the most successful experiment so far in how to live a contented life in a post-work world has been conducted in Israel. There, about 50% of ultra-Orthodox Jewish men never work. They dedicate their lives to studying holy scriptures and performing religious rituals. They and their families don't starve, partly because the wives often work, and partly because the government provides them with generous subsidies and free services, making sure that they don't lack the basic necessities of life. That's universal basic support, avant la lettre. Although they are poor and unemployed, in survey after survey, these ultra-Orthodox Jewish men report higher levels of life satisfaction than any other section of Israeli society. This is due to the strength of their community bonds, as well as to the deep meaning they find in studying scripture and performing rituals. A small room full of Jewish men discussing the Talmud might well generate more joy, engagement, and insight than a huge textile sweatshop full of hard-working factory hands. In global surveys of life satisfaction, Israel is usually somewhere near the top, thanks in part to the contribution of these jobless, poor people. Secular Israelis often complain bitterly that the ultra-Orthodox don't contribute enough to society and live off other people's hard work. Secular Israelis also tend to argue that the ultra-Orthodox way of life is unsustainable, especially as ultra-Orthodox families have 7 children, on average. Sooner or later, the state will not be able to support so many unemployed people, and the ultra-Orthodox will have to go to work. Yet it might be just the reverse. As robots and AI push humans out of the job market, the ultra-Orthodox Jews may come to be seen as the model for the future, rather than as a fossil from the past. Not that everyone will become Orthodox Jews and go to yeshivas to study the Talmud, but in the lives of all people, the quest for meaning and community might eclipse the quest for a job. If we manage to combine a universal economic safety net with strong communities and meaningful pursuits, losing our jobs to algorithms might actually turn out to be a blessing. Losing control over our lives, however, is a much scarier scenario. Notwithstanding the danger of mass unemployment, what we should worry about even more is the shift in authority from humans to algorithms, which might destroy any remaining faith in the liberal story and open the way to the rise of digital dictatorships. 3. Liberty. Big data is watching you. The liberal story cherishes human liberty as its number one value. It argues that all authority ultimately stems from the free will of individual humans, as expressed in their feelings, desires, and choices. In politics, liberalism believes that the voter knows best. It therefore upholds democratic elections. In economics, liberalism maintains that the customer is always right. It therefore hails free market principles. In personal matters, liberalism encourages people to listen to themselves, be true to themselves, and follow their hearts, as long as they do not infringe on the liberties of others. This personal freedom is enshrined in human rights. In Western political discourse, the term liberal is sometimes used today in a much narrower partisan sense to denote those who support specific causes such as gay marriage, gun control, and abortion rights. Yet most so-called conservatives also embrace the broad liberal worldview. In the United States, for example, both Republicans and Democrats should occasionally take a break from their heated quarrels to remind themselves that they all agree on fundamentals, such as free elections, an independent judiciary, and human rights. In particular, it is vital to remember that right-wing heroes, such as Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, were great champions not only of economic freedoms, but also of individual liberties. In a famous interview in 1987, Thatcher said, "There is no such thing as society. There is a living tapestry of men and women, and the quality of our lives will depend upon how much each of us is prepared to take responsibility for ourselves." Thatcher's heirs in the Conservative Party fully agree with the Labour Party that political authority comes from the feelings, choices, and free will of individual voters. When Britain needed to decide whether it should leave the European Union, Prime Minister David Cameron didn't ask Queen Elizabeth II, the Archbishop of Canterbury, or the Oxford and Cambridge Dons to resolve the issue. He didn't even ask the Members of Parliament. Rather, he held a referendum in which each and every Brit was asked, "What do you feel about it?" You might counter that people were asked, "What do you think?" rather than, "What do you feel?" But this is a common misperception. Referendums and elections are always about human feelings, not about human rationality. If democracy were a matter of rational decision-making, there would be absolutely no reason to give all people equal voting rights, or perhaps any voting rights at all. There is ample evidence that some people are far more knowledgeable and rational than others, certainly when it comes to specific economic and political questions. In the wake of the Brexit vote, eminent biologist Richard Dawkins protested that the vast majority of the British public, including himself, should never have been asked to vote in the referendum because they lacked the necessary background in economics and political science. You might as well call a nationwide plebiscite to decide whether Einstein got his algebra right, or let passengers vote on which runway the pilot should land. However, for better or worse, elections and referendums are not about what we think. They are about what we feel. And when it comes to feelings, Einstein and Dawkins are no better than anyone else. Democracy assumes that human feelings reflect a mysterious and profound free will, that this free will is the ultimate source of authority, and that while some people are more intelligent than others, all humans are equally free. Like Einstein and Dawkins, an illiterate maid also has free will, and therefore on election day her feelings, represented by her vote, count just as much as anybody else's. Feelings guide not just voters, but their leaders as well. In the 2016 Brexit referendum, the Leave campaign was headed by Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. After David Cameron resigned, Gove initially supported Johnson for the premiership, but at the very last minute, Gove declared Johnson unfit for the position and announced his own intention to run for it. Gove's action, which destroyed Johnson's chances, was described as a Machiavellian political assassination. But Gove defended his conduct by appealing to his feelings, explaining, "In every step in my political life, I have asked myself one question. What is the right thing to do? What does your heart tell you?" That's why, according to Gove, he fought so hard for Brexit, and that's why he felt compelled to backstab his erstwhile ally, Boris Johnson, and make a bid for the Alpha Dog position himself, because his heart told him to do it. This reliance on the heart might prove to be the Achilles heel of liberal democracy. For once somebody, whether in Beijing or in San Francisco, gains the technological ability to hack and manipulate the human heart, democratic politics will mutate into an emotional puppet show. Listen to the algorithm. The liberal belief in the feelings and free choices of individuals is neither natural nor very ancient. For thousands of years, people believed that authority came from divine laws rather than from the human heart, and that we should therefore sanctify the word of God rather than human liberty. Only in the last few centuries did the source of authority shift from celestial deities to flesh and blood humans. Soon, authority might shift again, from humans to algorithms. Just as divine authority was legitimized by religious mythologies, and human authority was justified by the liberal story, so the coming technological revolution might establish the authority of big data algorithms, while undermining the very idea of individual freedom. As mentioned in the previous chapter, scientific insights into the way our brains and bodies work suggest that our feelings are not some uniquely human spiritual quality, and they do not reflect any kind of free will. Rather, feelings are biochemical mechanisms that all mammals and birds use in order to quickly calculate probabilities of survival and reproduction. Feelings aren't based on intuition, inspiration, or freedom. They are based on calculation. When a monkey, mouse, or human sees a snake, fear arises because millions of neurons in the brain swiftly calculate the relevant data and conclude that the probability of death is high. Feelings of sexual attraction arise when other biochemical algorithms calculate that a nearby individual offers a high probability of successful mating, social bonding, or some other coveted goal. Moral feelings, such as outrage, guilt, or forgiveness, derive from neural mechanisms that evolved to enable group cooperation. All these biochemical algorithms were honed through millions of years of evolution. If the feelings of some ancient ancestor were wrong, and as a result that person made a fatal mistake, the genes shaping these feelings did not pass on to the next generation. Feelings are therefore not the opposite of rationality. They embody evolutionary rationality. We usually fail to realize that feelings are in fact calculations, because the rapid process of calculation occurs far below our threshold of awareness. We don't feel the millions of neurons in the brain computing probabilities of survival and reproduction. So we erroneously believe that our fear of snakes, our choice of sexual mates, or our opinions about the European Union are the result of some mysterious free will. Though liberalism is wrong to think that our feelings reflect free will, up until today, relying on feelings still made good practical sense. For although there was nothing magical or free about our feelings, they were the best method in the universe for deciding what to study, whom to marry, and which party to vote for. And no outside system could hope to understand my feelings better than me. Even if the Spanish Inquisition or the Soviet KGB spied on me every minute of every day, they lacked the biological knowledge and the computing power necessary to hack the biochemical processes shaping my desires and choices. For all practical purposes, it was reasonable to argue that I have free will, because my will was shaped mainly by the interplay of inner forces, which nobody outside me could see. I could enjoy the illusion that I controlled my secret inner arena, while outsiders could never really understand what was happening inside me and how I make decisions. Accordingly, liberalism was correct in counseling people to follow their hearts rather than the dictates of some priest or party apparatchik. However, soon computer algorithms might be able to give you better counsel than human feelings. As the Spanish Inquisition and the KGB give way to Google and Baidu, free will likely will be exposed as a myth, and liberalism might lose its practical advantages. for we are now at the confluence of two immense revolutions. Biologists are deciphering the mysteries of the human body, and in particular of the brain and human feelings. At the same time, computer scientists are giving us unprecedented data processing power. When the biotech revolution merges with the infotech revolution, it will produce big data algorithms that can monitor and understand my feelings much better than I can,